Welcome to episode 11 of our show, which of course is being released on 12/12/2006, so it makes sense to be episode 11, and should have thought about that when we started. I'm going to blame Sam on that one. But we have a great show for you today, as we always do. We're going to start off by talking a bit about the Oscars and talk about the Academy Awards prediction, get a feel for what might be nominated and what might be winning. We got a trivia question, as always. We're going to do a double feature where we talk about two different movies, and this is an interesting double feature you'll definitely want to check out. Two movies that you would never think should be put together, we think work well together and complement one another nicely. We have another entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary where we're going to talk about some more editing moves. Here we have fades, dissolves, that sort of thing, and what they are and how they work. We're going to have a top six about really fast-paced movies, which will be a lot of fun because I can talk really quick if I need to. And we're going to continue our Best Of series where we take a decade at a time. And this time we're going to be talking about the 1960s and the best films from that decade. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and I'd just like to thank all the Academy and the audiences who went to listen to my podcast, and
thank my parents and my third grade teacher,
Mrs. Hines.
Dude, you're not getting an award. You didn't win anything. Okay. Well, once Sam recovers, we're going to start talking about the Oscars for real.
As promised, we're going to be talking a bit about the Oscars, and specifically warming up for the Oscars this year. It is December, and that means the season is already in full swing if you're in the industry, and if you're not, maybe you're just starting to hear about the buzz of a lot of performances and films that may be making the nominees, which would be announced next month. But first, Stephen, let's talk a bit about why people like us, who don't really have any stock in who wins or loses, why would we be interested in following the Academy Awards?
Because we're nerds.
Okay, what else?
it's a tough thing to say. I think it's just because, you know, it's fun to talk about movies and debate movies, and this is one of the few times where it seems like lots of people are interested in talking about what the best movie is. And, you know, it's pretty hard to actually have that conversation outside of December through February or so. So it's just fun. And it's just also that sense of competition, like anything. Like, you know, why do people follow sports? For very similar reason. You know, you don't personally have any real stock invested in your local sports team that you root for, but it's just fun to see your movie win or lose or whatever. You know, we find one that you like, and you're like, okay, I want that one to win.
Yeah.
I just think there's a lot of that that's fun.
Yeah, we have a mutual friend named Trip Payne who comes to the Rinkworks website about every year. He shows up out of nowhere and then goes away again after the Oscar season's over, but he likens it to his Super Bowl. This is his Super Bowl, the Academy Awards. And, you know, yeah, it doesn't even make sense really to have movies compete with each other, but we all like competition. It's just something ingrained in us, and if it's combined with something else we like the movies in this case, then that sort of has an appeal. The other reason I like it, and I think you actually mentioned this on our website originally, but it encourages different kinds of movies to be made. Usually you got the big blockbusters that come out, try to make movies that the most people will want to see, and then in this one season of the year, they come out with a bunch of movies that are designed to, you know, appeal to different tastes and get the Academy Award, because if you win an Academy Award, especially the big ones, then that can translate into more box office later as it gets people more interested in a type of movie that they may not even ever see without these.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of neat, too. And I mean, I think I mentioned on the website as well that this is the one time where actually getting critical success can really help a movie. Generally speaking, good reviews I don't think really affect the box office a whole lot, except in a few rare cases. But definitely getting an Oscar nom or an Oscar win for Best Picture or something, that will get people to see the movie. And so that's awesome that it encourages studios. There's a real, I mean, that, you know, every company is a bottom line company. And so movie studios, when they see a critical recognition affecting their bottom line, you know, it really helps encourage them to make these good movies.
Yes, and of course, the Academy Awards originated as a publicity device. They started back in 1928, and the ceremony was held months after the winners were announced. But the awards were given out months later at this private dinner party at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel in May 1929. The ceremony lasted 15 minutes. It was the only ceremony not to be broadcast on radio or television. Obviously, it has changed since then.
Now it's about 15 hours.
In fact, very quickly, it evolved into this big industry event we know today. But the original ones were very specifically designed in order to publicize the movies and also improve their image a little bit. There were a number of scandals happening at the time, and the movie-making business was seen as this place of immoral debauchery. And so the awards were held as a way to highlight, hey, movies can be art, they can be respectable. But now today, of course, the media starts anticipating and prognosticating the Oscars like 30 weeks in advance or something. It's just insane. Well, this year, let's talk a bit about that. At this point, not quite all the movies of 2006 have been seen, but most of the likely Oscar players have. Screenings for the Academy, of course, often start running well before the theatrical release for the public, and there are seemingly three movies that everybody agrees are going to show up in the list of Best Picture nominees and probably Best Director as well. One is Dreamgirls, kind of an old-fashioned let's-put-on-a-show musical, starring Beyoncé, Jamie Foxx, Eddie Murphy, and really interestingly, Jennifer Hudson. She was the seventh final list on a season of American Idol, not really a rank that puts you in line for fame and fortune necessarily, but it's certainly a better move into movies than Kelly Clarkson and Justin Guarini made. They were the top two in season one and made the movie From Justin to Kelly, which is ridiculed pretty much across the board, even by American Idol fans, as just a horrific movie. But Jennifer Hudson is really getting a whole lot of Oscar attention, not just for the movie Dreamgirls, but herself as well in the Best Supporting Actress category. So that'll be really interesting to see. It's just the strangest way for a new star to emerge.
You know, Sam, what is it with the last couple of years, these like biopics about musicians? We had Ray, and then the next year Walk the Line, and then this year we have Dreamgirls.
Yeah.
What is this, just a
fad. People are interested in biopics in general these days, and of course if you got a musical star that you're making your movie about, then there's a lot of good opportunities to throw some music in.
This is not officially a biography of anybody, but yeah, it is. Not so veiled Portrait of the Supremes.
No, there's nothing like that at all.
Okay.
That's so silly. I don't see where you see the resemblance. Well, the number two, I'm not going in order necessarily, but number two out of the three that everybody thinks will be there is The Queen. And this is a film about the British royal family and Queen Elizabeth II in particular in the times following the death of Princess Diana. And there was a debate between Elizabeth II and the Prime Minister about whether or not there should be a royal funeral and all these different kinds of things that kind of balance tradition with the popular perception of Princess Diana as this very famous and very well-liked person. And number three, The Departed, Martin Scorsese's very well-received remake of Hong Kong's Infernal Affairs. Interesting here, Martin Scorsese was, I'm not going to say he made Gangs of New York and The Aviator just to chase the Oscar, but clearly that was one of the things that he did, that they were very much Oscar movies, and he made it known that he wanted an Academy Award, and he got nominated both times and then didn't make it, and now he just went back to doing something he wanted to do, and this may be his year. He may wind up with the Best Director statuette after all.
It's interesting because, of course, Gangs of New York was 2002, The Aviator was 2004, and here The Departed, 2006. You know, it's like every 2 years, the guy's directing stuff that's nominated for Best Picture. And I think here he's going to have a real, unofficially nominated, but I'd be really surprised if The Departed's not nominated across the board in lots of categories. That's a good streak.
And you've seen this movie. I haven't seen it yet, but I understand that you liked it quite a bit.
Oh, I loved it. It remains my favorite film of the year. I haven't seen anything I liked more yet.
Okay.
But, there's still a lot of time left. There's a month, but in movie time, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
All the good movies are coming out right now. They're packing the theaters.
Right. Well, assuming those three movies make it, that leaves two more slots. We get five nominees each year. Although at this point, seemingly most prognosticators, if you go out and read the internet, all the people that love to talk about the Oscars and predict them, everybody seems to think there are four locks for Best Picture, and they all differ about what that fourth one is. Obviously, they're not locks. Some say it's Little Miss Sunshine, a comedy drama that opened quietly last summer to great word of mouth and has continued to play throughout the fall. Some say it's Babel, the latest dark jump-around-in-time film from Alejandro González Iñárritu. You saw this too, right, Stephen?
Yeah, and I also saw Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, neither. I can't really see either one of them really being Best Picture material.
Interesting.
So I liked Little Miss Sunshine a lot. I hear it's a lot better on a second viewing, so maybe that's the thing.
Maybe so.
I don't know.
Well, others say it's Volver, a Spanish drama with Penelope Cruz, who's actually getting a lot of attention for herself in the Best Actress category. We'll see if she makes it or not, but it's a real landmark performance from her. Others say it's Letters from Iwo Jima, the second of two Iwo Jima films made by Clint Eastwood this year. The first, Flags of Our Fathers, was thought to be a forerunner in the Oscars before its release, and then it came out and people were a little disappointed, but it tells the story from the American side. And the second, Letters from Iwo Jima, reportedly a much better film, tells the story from the perspective of the Japanese, and it's in Japanese, and it has a Japanese author and screenwriter, but it's a really interesting project, this one director exploring the same event from different sides.
Yeah, and being released so close together, too. Of course, originally Letters from Iwo Jima wasn't supposed to come out this year. I think after sort of the reception to Flags of Our Fathers, it's been sort of released a little earlier than anticipated.
Yeah.
In fact, it's still not really been seen by many people.
Right.
Obviously, it hasn't been released in theaters, and so the screenings have been... I don't think there's been a lot of them, but I'm very, very, very interested in this movie.
And this is sort of what Clint Eastwood did with Million Dollar Baby, which did win the Best Picture a couple of years ago. He waited kind of until the last minute and said, yeah, let's throw it in the Oscar race this year, after all, and having a December release, but that was quite a successful thing for him. I kind of hope it doesn't happen again, though. I mean, if so, then it'll be the third Best Picture in a row that will have had either Paul Haggis and or Clint Eastwood involved in it. I think it's time to spread the wealth a little bit. I don't know. If it's a great movie, it's a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't mind either of those other two Eastwood or Haggis films winning. They're both great movies.
Yeah, they are. And other possibilities are The Pursuit of Happiness, the forthcoming drama with Will Smith, who seems like a lock for Best Actor, at least. Little Children, a disturbing psychological drama from the director of In the Bedroom, which I thought was pretty overrated when it won its Best Picture nomination a few years ago. But I don't know that Little Children's going to make it. It might, but it's a lot heavier, a lot more disturbing, and the Academy doesn't really like to go that far outside of safe boundaries. They want to push the envelope. They don't want you to blow through it and incinerate it, you know.
Exactly.
Notes on a Scandal, a psychological thriller that probably wouldn't be getting awards attention, except that it pairs up Judi Dench and Cate Blanchett and supposedly has absolutely fantastic performances by those two in it. No surprise there. Another one, Pan's Labyrinth, a dark fantasy by Guillermo del Toro, which I guess functions as a fantasy fable, but also as an allegory about fascism in post-World War II Spain, and so you have a fantasy with some meat underneath it that the Academy can feel good about nominating. And of course, there are the two 9-1-1 sagas, United 93 and World Trade Center. Well, Stephen, what interests you, we've talked about some of the movies, what interests you about this year's Oscars season in general, if anything?
Well, I'm kind of interested in the diversity of films, really. In addition to those that you mentioned, there's also, I think, Borat as a possible Dark Horse nomination just because it was so popular. I mean, both with audiences and with critics. And I think the Academy likes to sort of sometimes honor those things that are surprise cultural phenomena. Think of movies like, I don't know, The Sixth Sense, which sort of blew up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't be too surprised to see Borat. It's certainly not a likely possibility, but it's a very real possibility. And it's just interesting that there's so much diversity this year. I mean, I feel like a lot of times it's just full of biopics and historical epics. And this year, I don't know, when you talk about like The Departed and The Queen and stuff, those aren't the sort of normal Oscar movies you necessarily think of.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's one of the things that interests me about this year as well. I don't necessarily think it's going to be the strongest year of recent memory. I haven't seen most of these movies yet, so maybe it will be. But yeah, certainly an interesting year. And I hope it really is Martin Scorsese's year finally to get a Best Director Oscar.
You know what, though? Honestly, I think the club of directors who have been nominated a whole lot and never won is actually a better club than the directors who have won.
It is a good club to be in.
When you're there with Robert Altman and stuff.
Robert Altman. Who else we got? We got Alfred Hitchcock is the famous
right.
one. Stanley Kubrick and Akira Kurosawa. Ingmar Bergman, I think.
Really, the directors who have been nominated several times and not won, that's a pretty exclusive club of just great artists. One thing that might be funny is if Robert De Niro were nominated and won, say, director for The Good Shepherd, which is supposed to be getting a bit of buzz. It'd be pretty funny if De Niro beat out Scorsese. I mean,
oh my goodness.
Do you think that would fracture their friendship?
Who knows?
Would Scorsese be a good loser?
Of course. Well, to give some background, if you're not familiar, Scorsese is famous for losing to actors. He lost for Raging Bull. He lost to Robert Redford in 1980. And in 1990, he lost to Kevin Costner. And recently, he lost to Clint Eastwood 2 years ago. Although that's a little different because Eastwood was established as a great director before. For that, so at least it's not his first time out. But yeah, that would be funny if it was De Niro. Of course, they made many movies together. And I'm sure if that happens in around 2015 or so, he'll be losing the director Oscar to Leonardo DiCaprio. So let's move on to actor and actress. There's a weird thing happening here. Usually, for whatever reason, the best actor nominees tend to be higher profile performances, either from popular movies or best picture nominees. And the best actress category tends to have a higher percentage of great performances from more obscure films. It seems like this year, however, it's the other way around. We got Ryan Gosling in the running for Half Nelson, Forrest Whitaker from The Last King of Scotland, and they're getting good Oscar attention, and Peter O'Toole, once again, in his first lead performance in years, starring in the movie Venus. This is quite remarkable. I mean, just me talking about this, unless you follow the awards, you've probably not heard of these movies yet, but supposedly very great performances. I hope O'Toole wins it, of course with the caveat that I haven't seen the movies, and maybe I'll change my mind once I do, but it'd be really kind of neat to correct things with him and Scorsese in the same year. O'Toole has been nominated 7 times, and if he is nominated this year and loses it again, it will be his 8th straight loss.
Well, he was also recently honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah.
And there was some talk when he was honored with it saying that maybe he didn't want it just now because he wasn't done trying to win a regular Oscar. Has anyone ever won an Oscar after they've won the Lifetime Achievement Award?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, it happened with Henry Fonda. Mm. He went the longest time without winning an award, and finally they gave him an honorary Oscar. And the very next year, he won it for On Golden Pond. So, in Best Actress, we have Helen Mirren playing Elizabeth II in The Queen, and she's considered the front-runner. The problem with being the front-runner early, however, is that people get tired and move on and find something else to be excited about. Meryl Streep is another likely nominee, and that's usually the case. It's any given year, you can probably bank on her being a nominee, but this time for a very unlikely movie. It's The Devil Wears Prada, made seemingly as a throwaway comedy for teenage girls, but it struck a chord and really caught on, particularly thanks to Streep's performance. And other possibilities are, as I said, Penelope Cruz and Judi Dench in Notes on a Scandal, Kate Winslet for Little Children. If she's nominated, it'll be her 5th nomination. She hasn't won any yet. Strangely enough, maybe Beyoncé for Dreamgirls, Kate Blanchett for any of 3 films, probably The Good German, Naomi Watts from The Painted Veil. There are a bunch of possibilities. I've only named maybe half of them. There's quite a number. Another is actually Annette Bening for Running with Scissors. Bening rather famously lost twice to Hilary Swank, but it doesn't feel like her year this year either, I don't think. So, how good are your prediction skills? Every year over at Rinkworks, we run an Academy Awards predictions game, usually 2 games, one for guessing the nominees in selected categories, and then later on another one for guessing the winners in every category. So, you log in and you make your guesses, and when the nominations are announced, we'll see how you did. Well, this year's nominations game begins December 12th, and that's today if you're listening to this episode the day it came out. Normally, the prize is the thrill of victory and the honor of having your name on top of the results chart, but we're going to do something a little different this year, right, Stephen?
Yeah, we're going to have an actual prize for the nomination game. We're going to give away a copy of Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies. Sidney Lumet is, of course, the great director of movies such as Murder on the Orient Express and 12 Angry Men and a lot of really famous, wonderful movies and director that both Sam and I love. And the book is an absolute must-read if you're all interested in films. It's a fairly thin volume, but just packed to the brim with good information about the technical aspects of movies and tons of fun stories about the various films he's worked on.
Yeah, and why decisions are made the way they are, how to work with people, that sort of thing. It's called Making Movies, but it's a great interest even if you're not interested in actually making movies. If you're just a fan of movies and maybe how they're made and what goes into putting them together, it's a very great read. We will be featuring that book on a future episode of All Movie Talk, but in the meantime, you can win this book if you play the nominations game and come out on top. But you do have to enter a code. We're not going to have this offer available to everyone, so the winner of the book is going to be the person with the most correctly predicted nominations in the game. Who has entered a code? When you log into the game, there'll be a space where you can enter a code, and we will only give out that code on All Movie Talk right here. So if you come to the Rinkworks website and you don't know about this podcast and you get in there, then you won't be eligible to win the prize. So what is our code, Stephen, that people should be entering in order to be eligible to win the book?
Well, it's easy. It's AMT, the first letters from each word and name of our show, All Movie Talk, AMT. So just go in there and you put in Alpha Mike Tango AMT in there, and you'll be eligible to win prizes. And it's one of the great benefits of listening to this show is we bribe you.
And of course, we'll have even better prizes for the winners' game, but for the nominations game, that's what we got. And the winner will be decided on the morning that the nominations are announced. And more information, just go to the Rinkworks website, and actually you can go to the All Movie Talk website, and we'll link you directly to the correct page on Rinkworks where you can get all the information about the contest. So we'll be checking in periodically as the weeks go by to give you an update on what has happened with the Oscars and how the playing field has changed. So stay tuned. This week's trivia question is a pretty obscure but fun little factoid. The question is, what was the first ever in-flight movie?
Mm.
And you can have partial credit if you can say about what year this would be. Don't say if you know, but do you have a guess even?
Snakes on a Plane?
Snakes? Yeah. No, it was Airplane.
Haha.
No. You know, Steven, I like movies.
You like movies?
I like movies.
You know, I actually, I like them too.
Do you?
Yep.
You know what I like more than a movie?
What's that?
Two movies.
Some sort of double feature?
Precisely. A double feature carefully assembled from two different movies that complement each other so well that the double feature is greater whole than the sum of its halves.
Like Legally Blonde Parts 1 and 2.
No, I don't think you quite...
Showa and Andy Warhol's Empire?
That's more like it, yeah. But the particular double feature I want to talk about today is Amelie, the French fantasy romance by director Jean-Pierre Jeunet, where a young Parisian woman brings joy to those around her in a colorful series of serendipitous adventures, followed by Jason X, the 10th film in the Friday the 13th series, with the undead, mute, zombie, serial killer Jason blasts off into outer space in the 25th century.
Yeah, that's pretty much my favorite double feature as well.
Is it?
Yeah, you know, I admire how both films explore the same themes about human behavior and social synergy from opposing perspectives, and together complete a comprehensive exploration of a single idea.
Yes, I was about to say exactly that. And do you know what else?
Yes, I sure do.
I thought you might.
But, okay, for the benefit of our listeners, you should go and explain what else.
Okay, I shall.
Good.
Both films are profoundly filmic.
Yes, profoundly filmic. That's exactly the word.
Just so, but let's explain why. First, we have Amelie, a fantastical French comedy, a colorful visual feast for the eyes. It's about a woman who discovers that her calling in life is to help people.
But not just to help them.
To be sure. Not just to help them, oh no. To help them in a delightfully convoluted...
And deliriously
convoluted ways, amusing herself and the audience in the process. But the central question...
The central question.
Do you know what the central question is?
I'm quite purpled from holding my breath in the greatest anticipation as I await your pronouncement to the central question.
The central question is that amongst all the myriad co-inhabitants of the globe that Amelie can help, can she in fact help herself?
I thought that perhaps might be the central question, and indeed, you did not disappoint.
It is a wondrous central question, is it not?
It is, and may anyone who says otherwise be flogged.
With electric barbed wire.
Because it's much easier, sometimes, to patch up someone else's life than to patch up one's own.
Thermodynamics, Stephen, laws which cannot be broken.
Except by Jason!
Just so, and a fine segue you have provided me for Jason X. Like Amelie, features a main character who proactively influences the lives of others.
Expecting, if I may add, no reward or recompense for his assistance.
You may indeed add, and may I add to your addition, that in an age where money seems to be all that talks, the stories of Amelie and Jason Voorhees, whose works are entirely charitable, are a breath of fresh air.
Heartwarming tales of encouragement in these cynical times.
Jason X, the 10th film in the highly acclaimed Friday the 13th series, is, in its own way, a visual feast.
Yet a very different sort of visual feast.
Yes, for where Amelie features endives and artichokes, Jason X takes a more of a raw meat approach. And whereas Amelie's services are of humanitarian aid anonymously rendered, Jason's have more of what we might call a negative connotation, and he's not shy about taking the spotlight.
Take credit for your work, is what I always say.
Yes, I thought you might rather more identify with Jason than Amelie.
But they're two sides of the same coin.
Indeed. In fact, where Amelie's specialty is with the more life-affirming landmarks of the human condition, Jason's lies, shall we say, more toward the end of the road.
It is, in fact, to kill people.
Well, yes, indelicately put, my friend, but quite direct, and it is, in fact, not just to kill people, but to do so in delightfully convoluted...
And deliriously.
Delightfully and deliriously convoluted ways, amusing himself and, well, himself... in the process.
I do hope there is a central question.
Your perspicacity is on point as always. There is certainly a central question.
May we impose upon you to tell us now this central question?
The central question is that amongst all the myriad co-inhabitants of the globe that Jason can kill, can he in fact kill himself?
I bask blissfully in the glow of the profoundness that pervades us all.
It's much easier sometimes to kill another than to kill oneself, is it not?
Indeed, it is not. Not.
And if Jason cannot kill himself, who can?
Not I, surely.
Nor I. Clearly, it is not difficult to understand how Amelie and Jason represent opposing manifestations of the same fundamental human drive that inhabits us all.
There is a little bit of Amelie and a little bit of Jason in all of us.
But just as it is difficult to identify the individual ingredients of a subtly refined meal, the ingredients of life are better studied in isolation. Amelie is sunny and timeless, representing goodwill and optimism, where Jason completes the portrait of the human soul with its grim, futuristic vision. Life and the human condition, you see, is a little bit of both, and having studied these ingredients in successive but separate viewings of Amelie and Jason X, we may then merge them together in our minds and come to a complete understanding of that fragile spark of humanity rooted deep within our souls that defines our being and our place and our purpose in the larger organism of society.
Very well put, Sam, but for the benefit of our audience who may not be as well educated in the filmic ways as we are, could you put that in slightly plainer terms?
In plainer terms, try to imagine Amelie conspiring to lift Jason's spirits when he's down, while Jason tries to skewer her with a meat cleaver.
I am imagining, as I have done many times before, that very thing.
Life is pretty much just like that.
I can feel the enlightenment seeping into my very soul as we speak.
And I too, Stephen, and I too.
But if I may be so bold...
Please bless us with your courageousness.
I rather fear that your otherwise exceptional plot-driven analysis has left unmentioned the particular duality I find most compelling.
I am enraptured in expectation that you shall shortly inculcate my eager mind by unleashing the illumination within you upon the world at large.
What?
Explain yourself.
It struck me instantly that the visual styles of both films in fact draw from a common influence.
Indeed?
For Jason X, director James Isaac clearly drew upon classic German expressionism for the look and feel of his film. The script, which places all the action inside a spaceship, in stark contrast to the prior films of the series which employed outdoor locations, allowed Isaac to film entirely on sets, a tactic perfected by the German filmmakers of the 1920s. This meant that Isaac had complete control over the look of each shot.
I do love a good auteur theory.
Notice how his precise use of mise-en-scene when framing shots, as the threat of danger from the Jason character grows, so do the sets seem to grow around the characters, boxing them in. In the world Isaac creates, the external space filmically reflects...
And dialectic montagely.
Dialectic montagely, yes, exactly. The external space filmically and dialectically montagely reflects the internal feelings of the characters.
I always thought it remarkable that Isaac was able to borrow so heavily from such expressionistic masterworks as The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, produced 1919 and released 1920, while infusing the classic techniques with an original vision of his own.
Your apt observation is conducive to my enthusiastic agreement.
By your leave...
I leave.
By your leave, I must confess with all due respect that at first glance it would seem to the untrained eye, though mind you I do not contradict where you are leading, but it would seem to me that your observation of expressionist influence would perhaps be applicable solely to Jason X, and not perhaps as aptly to Amelie?
A percipient question, Sam, and one I had not left unanticipated, and indeed Amelie's connection to expressionistic techniques typically employed to enhance dark emotions is the greater challenge to establish. To do so, we must move back in time a bit.
Back in time?
Precisely.
Just as Jason moves forward in time to the 25th century, so in our analysis of its counterpart Amelie do we stage a chronological retreat?
Exactly. For it is two of Junet's earlier films that demonstrate the obvious links between expressionism and a style used in Amelie, and in turn establish the synchronicity of the artistic modus operandi of both Junet and James Isaac. In Delicatessen, Jeunet brought a dark comic tale of post-apocalyptic France to life, with a style that seemed to blend the tone and psychology of German Expressionism with the grittier aspects of later European film movements. In particular, Delicatessen draws from Italian neorealism, its depictions of streets and a ruined France. It is hard to watch the film without images of a war-torn Italy for movies such as Rome, Open City, or The Bicycle Thief playing in one's mind.
Might I interject a title of my own?
Do please.
It occurs to me, now that you mention it, the similarity to L'Avventura by Michelangelo Antonioni and his initial experimentation with blending Italian neorealist techniques with a dark, fantastical undercurrent that challenges our very existence. A threat much like that which Jason Voorhees himself exhibits in a more manifestly physical manner.
An astute observation that ever so much justifies its disclosure.
But do please continue.
As his follow-up to Delicatessen, Jeunet created City of Lost Children, again, a dark, expressionistic film where the sets reflect the psychology of the characters. Here, however, Jeunet begins drawing from more classically French films, abandoning all pretense of realism and moving into the formalism for which French cinema is so revered.
I revere formalism!
His whimsical camera is everywhere, moving freely on elaborate sets. It's clear that Jeunet is a student of the French New Wave and has merged the techniques of filmmakers such as Truffaut and Godard with the German style of art direction, which brings us to Amelie and Jason X.
I thought as much.
Amelie is a lighter film than Jeunet's previous efforts. Or is it? While the story is certainly lighter, the visual style still betrays its German roots. The movie is photographed in a visually compelling, lush, vivid manner, but its sets and art direction still reflect the psyche of its characters. Note particularly how Jeunet moves the camera around his main character.
Duly noted, particularly.
One especially compelling shot starts from underneath a bridge on which Amelie stands, and then moves from underneath to above her. It leaves us and the audience confused.
And dazzled once we are over it.
Yes, but it reflects her internal confusion and lack of direction.
You're right, Stephen. This is classic expressionism at its very core, of the very kind Jason X also employs to convey the complex psychological tortured states of its characters.
But there is more.
Pray tell.
As I've also established...
Aptly, if I may say so.
Thank you, yes. As I've also aptly established, Amelie draws upon the French New Wave, and yet, so too does director James Isaac, undoubtedly a serious student of French cinema, seek inspiration from the French New Wave.
For example?
Consider the scene in which Jason encounters a simulation of a previous Jason film.
Ah, yes, the immortal simulation scene.
Here, Isaac is calling our attention to the fact that we are watching a film by exposing the clichés in the series of which Jason X is a part.
Yes, a resounding breach of the fourth wall.
Certainly, certainly a most resounding breach of the fourth wall, this sort of self-reflexiveness that is a favorite technique of French directors during the 1960s, and Isaac uses it here to play with the audience. Here, he seems to be saying, you are watching a movie! This is not real!
I can hear him now.
He is winking at us in the style of the greatest French directors.
I do so adore a good French wink.
Do you think, Sam, that we are seeing a resurgence of classic European cinema techniques in the popular films of the new century?
I suspect we have incontrovertibly established our answer to that in the affirmative.
But I digress.
I do so adore a good digression.
The point is simply that we clearly have established both Amelie and Jason X are cinematic siblings, painted with the same brushstrokes.
And investigating the relationships between self and society.
Do you know what would provide a fitting final chapter in this trilogy?
What would provide a fitting final chapter in a trilogy?
A crossover film.
Starring Amelie and Jason X together?
The very thing.
By the esteem of my humble perception, I do believe you have hit upon the right of it. Amelie and Jason.
Manifestations of essentially the same character.
Who seem tragically able to furnish everyone but themselves with their own services.
If Amelie cannot help herself, would she be able to help Jason, with whom she is in one spirit but manifest before her as another?
And could Jason in turn engage a voyage of self-discovery to learn, through Amelie, how to kill himself?
Clearly, we have struck upon a deeply philosophical premise for a film, one only the most intellectual and insightful of all directors would be suited to do justice.
McG?
So last week, in our increasingly regular Film Buffs Dictionary, Sam talked a bit about match cuts, and we're going to continue talking about some editing. This time we're not going to talk about cutting so much, or rather we're going to talk about sort of a special way of cutting. We're going to talk about fades, dissolves, and wipes. These are all transitions between images, but rather than the harsh abruptness of a cut, it gives you sort of a slower transition between images. It's gradual and takes a little while. So the first is the fade, and this is pretty famous, and I'll bet most of you know what it is. The traditional way to start a movie is to open with black screen, right, so no image, and then gradually, first shot of the movie is superimposed over the black screen, and eventually it fades in. That's what they call it, a fade in, so that all you see is now the shot of the film, and the movie starts. And the opposite is the fade out. It's the traditional way to end a movie, you fade to black. And so you start with the image, and you superimpose a black screen until all that we see is black, and then, you know, you roll credits or whatever. And so this is pretty common ways to begin and end a movie, but a lot of times fades are used during a movie as a way of editing. For instance, you can fade to other colors. A lot of times you'll see like a fade to white, and then, you know, maybe you'll pan down and see that it was like an overexposed sky or something, and the character's waking up outside after an explosion. Like, you see that kind of thing a lot. And you can sometimes we'll see a series of fade to black and then fade in. So, you know, you'll have a shot, fade to black, fade back in, fade to black, fade back in, that kind of thing. And a lot of times this is used to illustrate, say, if a character is gaining and losing consciousness, you see this. Movie trailers do this sort of thing a lot to, say, move between scenes or to emphasize something. And if you want to see a really great example of the effect that fades can have, the Special Edition Fight Club DVD on the second disc, so I think you have to get the two-disc set, that I think is out of print, but it has a great bit illustrating. There's a sequence in that movie where they use fades, fade to black, and fade back in to illustrate the character, like I said, kind of coming in and out of consciousness. And the directors actually included the original version of that scene without the fades, with just cuts, and it's really interesting to see how it plays completely differently. Now, dissolve is something very similar to a fade, but instead of fading to a single color, you're fading from one image to another. It's often used to show transition. For instance, you want to add time between two images, so you show the passing of time. Sort of the cliche is, if you want to show the passing of seasons, you'll show a tree with like bright leaves in the spring, and then we dissolve to another image of the tree with like snow on it to show, you know, that, oh, now it's winter, that kind of thing. So you see that a lot. And you sometimes use dissolves to juxtapose two objects and compare them or to contrast them. And in Sam talked about match cuts last week, I think some of them might have actually been dissolves. For instance, the opening shot of Citizen Kane, where we move from various shots of Xanadu and seeing the lighted window, those were actually, I believe, dissolving from frame to frame. And so it shows more of a sort of progression. It's a little more gradual than just cutting. Cutting is rather abrupt and sharp. There's also a very famous shot in an Ingmar Bergman movie called Persona, where it's about these two actresses who are basically playing the same character, sort of. And there's a part where we see one of them and we sort of dissolve into the other one. The idea is, okay, now these actually are the same people. And that's the kind of thing that gets used a lot in dissolves.
One other great use of dissolves is to show the passage of time. And to illustrate this, the best way is to see a movie called Paris When It Sizzles. It was made in the 60s and has William Holden and Audrey Hepburn. And he's a screenwriter and she's visiting. I don't remember why she's there exactly, but as it turns out, they end up writing a movie together. And they don't even seem to have a good sense of what kind of movie it is. It kind of shifts genres a little bit. But as they write, we see the image of the imagined final movie, but the audio is still them narrating what is going to happen. And because she's not experienced as a screenwriter, he ends up explaining a lot of film devices and grammar to her. And so there's this one point where he explains what a dissolve does and what it can do for you. And so the example is the two people sit down to dinner and they're just about to order. The waiter comes over and he says, now we do a dissolve here because we don't want to go through all the process of seeing them order. That's not interesting to the viewer of the movie. So we'll do a dissolve into a new shot that is a little closer up, and then we get right to their conversation after they have ordered. And as William Holden is saying this, we see it on the screen, and it's actually quite striking. Oh yeah, that was a very natural way to express the passage of time, and I've probably seen that in many other movies and not really consciously realized it, but this movie draws attention to that and kind of teaches you about what the dissolve does.
Right, and of course, if you had just cut there, you know, you start from the waiter, what would you like to order, and you just cut to them being done, it would be too abrupt. It would seem strange. Like, what happened? You know, you'd think something was missing.
Yeah.
Well, the most obvious transition, the one that really calls attention to itself, fades and dissolves, and cuts even are kind of subtle, the wipe. The screen wipe is obvious, and this is where one image just replaces the other by the new image moving spatially into the frame, sort of wiping away the old image. Often, you'll see a wipe will come in from the side or from the top. Very, very commonly used by people who just got access to digital video software, right? I mean, all those people who have digital camcorders and are playing around on their Macintosh with iMovie or whatever, and they have scenes are transitioning between like stars or circles constantly, and it's really annoying. That's the screen wipe. But it can be used well. A lot of times it's used really cheesily, and also like low-budget television commercials love the wipe. But it can be used well. Akira Kurosawa very famously used wipes all the time to show transitions and to call attention to the changing of scenes, and it's kind of fun. George Lucas, who borrowed a lot from Kurosawa, also really borrowed the wipes that Kurosawa used for Star Wars. So the Star Wars movies, probably the most famous example, constantly, every other scene wipes in an interesting way. Sometimes, rather than just, you know, moving left or right or up and down, those the sort of like the clockwise spiral wipe where the image seems to be replaced by this, you know, moving clock hand. It's kind of interesting.
This week, our top six list was about movies that are engrossing and compelling despite being paced slowly. This week's top six list is a complement to that, movies that are engrossing and compelling and paced very fast!
Phew.
I'm going to slow down now.
Okay, please. You're hurting me. Yeah. You're hurting me. I was getting all nervous and tense. I don't know why.
Okay. This is quite the opposite of last week's topic, if that isn't already clear. Because these two topics relate differently to the common perception that slow movies are boring and fast movies are exciting. In reality, I think that probably only applies to bad movies, which, if they're slow, are agonizing, and if they're fast, are at least stimulating, maybe not exciting. But a great movie is exciting no matter how it's paced. The challenge of a slow movie is to sustain interest, and the challenge of a fast movie is not to upstage itself with its own deluge of things that it throws at you. So let's get started. My number six is a recent work by a great director. I think probably his best movie, but certainly his best in the last 20 years. It's Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down, a movie that chronicles a U.S. military raid in Somalia, where about 100 Army Rangers were dropped into the capital city. This is an exciting, visceral ride of a movie once it gets going, that while certainly confusing about a lot of details, like differentiating between the characters that all look alike, does a great job of conveying a good overall sense of what's happening, despite absolutely breakneck pacing in the action. By the way, I don't know for sure. I think this movie possibly expends more rounds of ammunition than any other movie, possibly every other movie combined, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot. And, you know, I mean, you say it's kind of confusing, but I think that's sort of the point, that battle was confusing for the troops who were in it. They got lost. No one knew where they were going, and so it's confusing, and it puts you as though you were actually there. I'm going to go ahead and make a note. I had way too many movies for my list, so I just had to just throw away all critical integrity and just pick movies I really like that are fast. So that's why there's almost no classics on my list. And so feel free to ridicule me on our website, allmovietalk.com. Anyway, I'm also going to make another mistake, and my number six pick is a movie I saw not too long ago, and that is The Departed, Martin Scorsese's 2006 gangster movie about traitors on both sides of the law. And once it starts, and it starts, the incident starts, it never freaking stops. It's, I don't think I've ever spent 2 hours more tense the entire time wondering what was going to happen next. Twists and turns constantly. The movie the movie establishes what's going on about halfway through. It more or less tells us what's happening, but it never stops to explain anything. We got to work the whole film, and we're constantly wondering, are these guys going to get found out? Are the mobsters going to realize that this guy's a cop? Are the cops going to realize that this guy's a gangster? And then, of course, the final half an hour, I think, is nothing but plot twists. I loved it. Few times in the movies, though, I remember just being so on the edge of my seat the entire time.
Interesting. I haven't seen The Departed yet, but I have seen Infernal Affairs that it's based on. That movie is, it starts quick and it has quick parts, but it definitely takes time to slow down.
And it's interesting because, of course, last week, my number six pick was a different Scorsese movie, Raging Bull. This is, and you know, Scorsese's done some fast-paced movies like Goodfellas and stuff, and this is faster. This is, yeah, ooh, boy, never stops.
Okay.
There are some, you know, small character scenes, but even those are fast.
All right. Well, when I came up with a short list for my top six, and I also had a pretty long short list, and I had a huge number of comedies. Not so many action movies, as you might think, but a lot of comedies. And my number five pick is one of the three that made it. I tried to diversify my genres, but it's the 1944 production of Arsenic and Old Lace, directed by Frank Capra and starring Cary Grant. Most of the screwball comedies from this time were pretty fast-paced, a lot of rapid-fire dialogue and everything, but this one possibly even more so than most, and it's such a riot. A lot of slapstick and zany situational humor, and also some subtler, nuanced humor blended in. So there are a few different levels of humor, but it really doesn't slow down a whole lot. It's about a man who, on his wedding day, discovers that his sweet, kindly spinster aunts like to sometimes, with only the best of intentions, mind you, kill people and bury them in their cellar. But they genuinely mean well, and of course there are all the usual situational complications, one on top of another, that build the humor to a frenzied pitch by the end.
And a wonderful cameo by one of my favorite presidents, Teddy Roosevelt.
I thought you were going to say Ben Stiller for a minute there.
Well, my number five pick is Fight Club from 1999 by director David Fincher. The movie is pretty fast-paced from beginning to end. It doesn't slow down a whole lot, and it's another movie with a big twist at the end. I like it a lot, though, because it starts off maybe a little bit slow, in which things are kind of hazy, but we're jumping between a lot of scenes. The narrator is constantly talking, explaining stuff, filling in details. And for about a guy who can't sleep and is going crazy, I think it works to be pretty quick-paced and not spend a whole lot of time setting things up and just let us run with it. It's a movie that you have to watch two or three times because entire scenes change their meaning after you've seen the movie all the way through. And so interesting, particularly fast in that regard, too, how much you miss the first time through.
Yeah, I missed why it was good. I've been kind of shying away from talking about this movie in too much detail on this show, because when I do finally talk about it, I want to go into detail about why I found this kind of disappointing. The nutshell is I thought the tone kind of undermined what it had to say, but yeah, I can't argue with you that it's fast-paced, so...
You just need to watch it again, because I thought that the same thing.
Yeah.
I saw it the first time, too.
Okay, well, maybe that's
it. And then I realized that I was completely wrong, and that it's a great, great film.
Well, my number four on my list is called Noises Off, one of the funniest movies I have ever seen. It's a 1992 adaptation of a stage play about a stage play. We witness the rehearsal of the first act of this play within a play, and that's funny enough, but even funnier is the incompetence and the weird interrelationships between the actors and the director played by Michael Caine. After the rehearsal, we see the first act played twice more in front of live audiences, and each time gets more and more out of control as the relationships between the actors deteriorate, like they rush on the stage and do their part and rush off, and then they'd be having these little spats with the actors and they'd barely make their next cues and that sort of thing. It's very complex, coordinated action, very fastly done. It's practically exhausting to try to watch this and not miss all the jokes, but it's so well done.
Yeah, I know, and I could have picked a bunch of screwball-esque comedies. I restricted myself to just one, which I'll get to in a little bit. But yeah, fast comedies are my favorite as well. Well, again, like I said, just throwing away all credibility, my number four pick is Sin City, my favorite movie from 2005, and I mean, that should pretty much disqualify me as a person to be taken seriously to begin with anyway. But Sin City is, I think the way to really describe it is hyper-noir. It's based on comic books, and it draws from a lot of those old noir elements from the 1940s, black and white photography, fast cars, and chicks who are called dames, but it just speeds it all up. My way of thinking about it is it's as if nobody stopped making noir pictures. This is the sort of noir movie we'd be making today if we hadn't stopped. It's noir on steroids, speeded up with modern sensibilities, lots of violence and humor, and just a wonderful, fast-paced movie that the first time I saw it, I remember just laughing with glee over how ridiculous it all was and how quick it was happening.
My number three is an action movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first Indiana Jones movie. Although it was inspired by James Bond and the old pulp serials of the 40s, this movie really felt like something fresh and new in 1981, and I think it can be credited with introducing the non-stop action-adventure genre, perhaps never done as well as in this movie, which does slow down here and there, but in general leaps from one incredible action scene to another with reckless abandon. The great opening sequence really sets the stage. First Indiana Jones is running away from a rolling boulder, and then he's being betrayed and then chased and then shot at, and this is just the kind of energy that the movie will sustain throughout most of its running time. Even though I know the movie pretty well, as I'm sure many of us do, it still hasn't lost its entertainment value at all for me.
Yeah, great pick. You know, I'm glad you mentioned it. It slows down from time to time, because I definitely think it does. Probably the scenes from the last 30 minutes or so aren't quite as fast-paced as the early parts, which is kind of interesting. It's usually the opposite. I definitely agree with that. That's a good pick. Well, my number three is the great musical by Baz Luhrmann from 2001, Moulin Rouge, which starts fast in its first 20 minutes. In fact, so fast that I think most people who see it get kind of turned off right at the beginning. But once you get used to the incredible pace, and, you know, we don't expect musicals to be that fast. It's cut fast. We jump around a lot, and there's this weird mashup of songs, and you have to really pay attention sometimes to figure out what the heck's happening. The storyline's not that complicated, but it doesn't introduce its characters in a very normal way. All of a sudden, when there's a narcoleptic Argentinian and a singer and a writer, and oh, they're all just there. But it's a great movie, a lot of fun. It's one of those ones, again, because you don't quite take it all in the first three times, it holds up really well in repeated viewings.
Yeah, with regard to the first 20 minutes or so, I kind of liken it to an overture. So you have an overture for, some kind of a musical, but it's like a jam-packed a little bit of themes from all the different songs that you're about to hear packed into one basically fast little capsule. And I think Moulin Rouge sort of does that visually. It has a 20 minutes or so of just all kinds of craziness, and it's really signaling you, okay, this is the kind of stuff that we're going to stretch out a little bit later.
Right.
And then it does slow down later on. But it's, yeah, you're right. It's so crazy. I mean, there's all kinds of overwhelming, trippy imagery that assaults you, and it really forced, I think it forces you to let go of any sense of rationality and just let the movie work as a ride of sound and visuals. It was my number two pick, and so back to you.
Well, then, I guess that saves us some time, doesn't it? It's fast-paced, just like our movies. Well, my number two is literally one of the fastest movies of all time. It's Requiem for a Dream by Darren Aronofsky from 2000. I'm not 100% certain if it still holds the record for the most cuts in sort of a mainstream film, but certainly when it was released, it has about twice the number of cuts that an average feature film has. So we're constantly cutting. It's a not-so-uplifting tale about drug addicts and how addiction affects you and can mess up your life, but Darren Aronofsky made the brilliant decision to just never really stop assaulting our senses. We get a good sense of maybe what it's like to be on speed or something because, hey, wow, things are going to come at us. Images are going to come at us super fast. And there's a bunch of these hyper-montage sequences where we see a bunch of almost still shots because they're so short that we're cutting up around, and it works well. It's definitely an assault on us. The movie is a little difficult to watch at times, though it's always understandable, which is nice, but we always know what's going on. But yeah, definitely throws a lot at us and is attacking us in the same way that drugs attack the senses. It's a good way of getting inside the characters' heads.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I really sometimes despise a lot of movies that use that editing style and don't need it. You just have like an action movie, or even worse, not even an action movie, but some kind of character drama, and you're cutting like that, it can kind of take you out of it. But if you're using it to make a point, the drug kind of trip sort of thing, it makes a lot more sense.
Right. I think the best example, especially we mentioned Moulin Rouge, is Chicago, the movie adaptation of Chicago,
yeah,
which uses a hyper-editing style and for no apparent reason.
And really undermines certain sequences.
Right. You just cut up all your dance numbers for no reason. It's
Well, my number one doesn't really use editing to achieve its fast pace, but the delivery and the action. It is Billy Wilder's 1-2-3, the 1961 Cold War satire starring James Cagney at his absolute best. It's terrifically well-written, one deviously clever line after another, dished out in machine gun-style delivery. By the early 60s, screwball comedies had sort of fallen out of fashion, but this one resurrects the tradition wonderfully well, and it even pushes it into fresh territory by unabashedly making fun of, well, basically every political stereotype ever. It also has a pretty unique flavor because it was shot in post-war Berlin, and interestingly, they started building the Berlin Wall during filming, and that meant certain reshoots had to take place in other locations. But even if you're not so much interested in political satire, I can practically guarantee you will find this one non-stop hilarious movie.
Well, my number one film is a little screwball comedy gem from 1961 by Billy Wilder called 1-2-3 as well. We actually didn't plan this. I was shocked that you also picked that. I thought you were going to be marveling at my wonderful pick for number one. But yeah, I mean, ditto, basically. If we're going to just be fast-paced, let's be fast-paced. I agree with your number one pick.
Excellent. You should say that more often. Okay, to recap the segment this week, my number six fast-paced film is Black Hawk Down from 2001. Number five, Arsenic and Old Lace from 1944. Let me pick this up a little bit. Number four, Noises Off, 1992. Number three, Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1981. Number two, Moulin Rouge, 2001. Number one, 1-2-3, 1961. That was a lot of numbers in a row.
And my top six fast-paced movies, which completely destroy all my credibility. Number six, The Departed from 2006 by Martin Scorsese. Number five, Fight Club from 1999 by David Fincher. Number four, Sin City from 2005 by Robert Rodriguez. Number three, Baz Luhrmann's 2001 film Moulin Rouge. Number two, The Drug Trippy film Requiem for a Dream from 2000 by Darren Aronofsky. And number one, The Same as the Sam, 1-2-3 by Billy Wilder from 1961.
You know, that was really fast, but also understandable.
Wow, that's amazing for me.
We're up to part four in our series called Best Of. And this is a series where we go through each year in film history, one year at a time, and talk about the best movies made that year. We'll also talk about the best picture-winning film from the Academy, and I'll also pick my favorite film from that year. The purpose is to give you some suggestions about some great movies to watch and give you a sense of the chronology of film history. So,
The 1960s, which we'll be covering this week, is when we see, well, depending on how you want to look at it, the movies either grew up or lost their innocence. In the mid-60s, breezy Doris Day comedies were the king of the box office, and in just a few years, spilling a little into the 1970s, the attention shifts over to smaller, more adult dramas. In the early 70s, had things like The Godfather, The French Connection, A Clockwork Orange, and so on. We'll see that that transition start to happen here. The Hays Code went away and was replaced by the MPAA ratings we have today in 1968. A lot of other countries had already had rating systems by that time. This is when we got ours. So the 1960s chronicles the end of an era. If you had to pick a single point in time where everything before it was an old movie, quote-unquote, and everything after it was a new movie, you'd probably draw that line right around the late 60s somewhere. It's here that you see the last of the great classic musicals and westerns, and the fashion for big sweeping costume epics comes to a temporary close.
So where are we going to get started? 1960?
In 1960, yeah. The best picture was called The Apartment, a great satirical dark comedy slash drama from Billy Wilder. Once again, though, most of the best pictures of the year went unnominated, and these would be Psycho, Inherit the Wind, The Dolce Vita, Peeping Tom, The Magnificent Seven, A Bout de Souffle, which is Breathless, La Ventura, and Spartacus. I think I have to fall back on Hitchcock once again for this one, though, and say Psycho. It was definitely underrated at the time, and actually, I think it still is.
Yeah, I like Psycho quite a bit, but I think the Academy got it right. I can't imagine a much better movie than The Apartment. I may be just a Billy Wilder fanboy, but it's the perfect blend of comedy and drama.
It's very good, yeah.
What about 1961?
In 1961, the Best Picture Award went to West Side Story, and other great movies made this year, Yojimbo, Judgment at Nuremberg, The Hustler, La Notte, 101 Dalmatians, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and The Guns of Navarone. I also have a soft spot for, speaking of Billy Wilder, 1-2-3, a madcap red curtain comedy that is just so hilarious, and I think not really appreciated and recognized as much as it should be. But I have to side with the Academy on this one. West Side Story is just terrific, slick and jazzy and very powerful.
I don't actually like West Side Story that much. I think it's
well, you can't get them all right.
I think it's well made, but the story doesn't work for me. I'd much rather have seen.
I actually think the story is an improvement on Romeo and Juliet.
Let's just forget you said any of that and move on to 1962.
Okay, well, if I haven't ruined my credibility, I will regain it here. The Oscar-winning Best Picture was Lawrence of Arabia, and I have to side with the Academy on that one. It's David Lean's best film and a real rarity when you think about it, a vast, expansive epic that is actually very personal and intimate character portrait. Now, other great movies that it made this year, The Longest Day, The Music Man, To Kill a Mockingbird, Birdman of Alcatraz, this is a good year for birds, I guess, Days of Wine and Roses, The Exterminating Angel, Jules and Jim, The Miracle Worker, Long Day's Journey into Night, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and The Manchurian Candidate, so it's a great year.
I don't know if it's such a good year for birds. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird, the birds aren't coming out too well on that one.
Okay, maybe so, and in Alcatraz, they're in jail, so you might be right.
Lawrence of Arabia, great, 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 great film. I can't say enough good about it.
Right.
1963?
1963, by contrast, was a pretty bad year for film, and the best of that year weren't even nominated by the Academy. The Best Picture went to Tom Jones, a movie people don't really seem to care much about today, and it's still overrated. It's got that one famous eating scene, and that's about it. But 1963 did have a few popular classics, From Russia with Love, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Jason and the Argonauts, The Birds, and Charade. But there are really only two films worthy of consideration as the best of the year, and I think even then it's no contest between the two. One is The Great Escape, that would be my runner-up, one of the most exciting concentration camp flicks. And the other, a clear winner, Federico Fellini's 8½, a surreal roller coaster ride through the fears and fantasies of a film director at a loss for inspiration for his next film.
You know, I liked The Great Escape a lot more when it was called Grand Illusion. Anyway, moving on to 1964.
1964 is one of my personal favorite years for movies, not so much for the number of great movies, but a lot of them are personal favorites of mine. Among them, Zulu, The Pawnbroker, A Hard Day's Night, which is the best of the rock and roll musicals, Woman in the Dunes, A Fistful of Dollars, the first spaghetti western, so we start to see the old classic style of westerns fading out and the spaghetti westerns and revisionist westerns taking their place. Also, Goldfinger, the definitive Bond film, although not quite the best. We also see Cold War paranoia reflected in a pair of cautionary tales called Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove. They're basically the same movie, except that Failsafe is serious and Dr. Strangelove is a satire, and of course it's the latter that proves to be truly transcendent and timeless. But for me, the best of the year comes down to two musicals. One is Mary Poppins, which is sorely underrated. I've thought for a long time that if you were a young or young at heart, and you can see only one movie and you don't care so much about the art of filmmaking, just as having a great time with something joyful, then you should see Mary Poppins. However, I have to agree with the Academy on this one and pick as the best film of 1964, My Fair Lady, one of the most elegant and eloquent films ever made.
For me, it's sort of a toss-up between My Fair Lady and Strangelove, but I think I give Strangelove the edge just because a nuclear holocaust is funnier than people talking weird.
Okay, well, that brings us up to 1965, and the best picture was The Sound of Music. I think there's an unfair backlash against this film today because it's just not cynical enough for today, I think.
Also not good enough.
But I think that's okay, and there aren't a lot of other choices either. But there are some, such as The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, The Flight of the Phoenix, and if you've seen only the remake, you should definitely check out the original. Also, Dr. Zhivago, A Thousand Clowns, Falstaff, which is also known as Chimes at Midnight. For lack of a better choice, I'm going to go with something relatively unknown. It's a fun little mystery thriller called Mirage, and it stars Gregory Peck as a man with amnesia who slowly pieces together a plot of intrigue as fragments of his memory gradually return. This basic idea has been used before and since to varying degrees of effectiveness, but so what? It's done well here, and the movie is a lot of fun. Definitely not a movie on the caliber of my other choices, but like I said, this is kind of a weak year, and I don't think I can go with The Sound of Music on this one.
Yeah, that's I pretty much take any movie besides The Sound of Music. Interesting dark horse choice there. I'll have to check it out sometime. 1966.
The best picture went to A Man for All Seasons. Another nominee was quite the unlikely one. The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. It's not great filmmaking, but a uniquely entertaining experience, so I support that nomination. Anyway, other choices, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Balthazar, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Fortune Cookie, El Dorado, Persona by Ingmar Bergman, Blow Up by Michelangelo Antonioni. My pick is The Battle of Algiers, an astonishing look at the Algerian Revolution against the French occupation. It has the look of a documentary, but packs a real dramatic punch and conveys an incredibly compelling sense of what it must have been like to live through these events.
I think that's a good choice. There's a lot of really, I think, strong movies here, but Battle of Algiers is definitely interesting, especially if you're interested in history, because as Americans, that's not really a war that we hear a whole lot about. 1967.
Best picture went to In the Heat of the Night, which was seen as a very socially progressive movie at the time. Other choices would be Bonnie and Clyde, Le Samurai, Belle de Jour, The Dirty Dozen, Wait Until Dark, In Cold Blood, To Sir With Love, and Cool Hand Luke. And if you just think about that list for a minute, you can kind of sense now that we're getting a lot grittier, getting a lot of a harder edge to the movies that we've seen just a few years prior. I should also mention The Graduate, which was made this year. It's considered by some to be one of the greatest of all movies. I really think it will be forgotten in time because it's just too tied to that particular generation to be enduring. It's like if you look at the people who call The Graduate their favorite movie, they're all about exactly 20 years older than the people who call Ferris Bueller's Day Off their favorite movie. Not that either one are bad, but my pick is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a comedy drama about race relations that, despite being made in 1967, is so much more insightful into human nature than a lot of the, well, excuse the pun, black and white racial dramas we have today.
Yeah, and I'm pretty surprised that Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is not that dated. I'd like to mention The Graduate, though. I'm not a huge fan of it either, I agree with you, but I think it won't be forgotten. It's such an interesting piece of filmmaking and so important to film history, I doubt that it's going to be forgotten.
Okay, that might be overstating the case, yeah.
It may not have the same status.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so also Bonnie and Clyde is a must-see movie for everyone who's at all interested in film history, a vital movie. 1968.
Some of the great films of 1968, The Odd Couple, Funny Girl, The Lion in Winter, Romeo and Juliet, the Zeffirelli version, Once Upon a Time in the West, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Producers, and Where Eagles Dare. Also a couple of popular hits that I actually don't much care for, like The Planet of the Apes and Night of the Living Dead. Now, the Academy made one of its less acclaimed Best Picture choices this year, but I have to agree with it. It's the musical Oliver by Carol Reed, who did The Third Man. I don't know how they did it, I really don't know, but they made a full-blown musical spectacle that actually preserves and even enhances that cold, harsh, grimy, dangerous Dickensian world of the novel. This is one of my absolute favorite films.
Because nothing screams Dickens like a wonderful musical.
Sure.
1969.
Best Picture went to Midnight Cowboy. I actually didn't like this at all. I thought it was good at conveying the impression of a weighty character drama, but ultimately failed at it. Maybe, as is the case with The Graduate, you just have to be from that generation. But I just don't think it has anything to say. This was also the year of Easy Rider, another movie I thought was overrated, though not by as much. Other choices here, Take the Money and Run, one of Woody Allen's earliest and funniest comedies. Also, Westerns kind of went out with a bang. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, True Grit, and The Wild Bunch. Actually, that last one feels more like a new beginning than an end, even though it's all about the end of an era. I also like The Italian Job quite a lot, but nothing really jumps out at me from this group as being something you'd call the best film of the year, so I think Butch Cassidy gets it by default.
Maybe not great, but a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah. So that brings us to the end of the 1960s, and next week we'll be talking about the 1970s, which is a very interesting transitory period, and so we'll do that next week.
Earlier in the podcast, I asked you all a pretty tough trivia question, and that was, what was the first ever in-flight movie? Got a guess? Other than Snakes on a Plane? Maybe you can guess the time period.
I don't really know that. I mean, it must have been with the introduction of video, so the 70s?
Ah, no. This would be around 1925. But you were close.
Oh, absolutely.
You had the right century. The answer is The Lost World, and it's not the Spielberg movie, but another movie about dinosaurs with that title. This one based on the Arthur Conan Doyle novel by that name. It was a silent movie released in 1925 starring Wallace Beery, which was not a wrestling picture, and the flight in question took place in April of that year. It was an Imperial Airways flight that flew from London to Paris. The other noteworthy thing about The Lost World is it's the first feature film to use stop-motion animation to bring creatures to life like this.
Out of curiosity, how did they show it? Did they actually have a projector running on the plane? I mean,
I guess so, and they would have had to, right?
Well, if there's, like, what, turbulence? And I mean, this is what that would work out too well.
It just made those dinosaurs all the scarier.
I guess so. So that wraps up our show for this week. Be sure to check us out next Tuesday. We'll have some more great stuff. And as always, check us out every day at the website. We update pretty much every single weekday with new stuff. The website is easy to remember. It's the name of the show, allmovietalk.com. So if you know the name of the show, you know the name of the site.
Also check out rinkworks.com, and we mentioned earlier the Academy Awards prediction game in the Oscar Watch segment, and that is going on at Rinkworks. You can find it by going to All Movie Talk and then following the link there. Next week is our special Christmas episode. It's not quite Christmas yet, but it's the last episode before Christmas Day, and so we're going to talk about our favorite Christmas movies and also continue our Best of series talking about the 1970s, a real great decade in cinema history. So check us out then.
Cut. That's a wrap, folks.